This is misleading. This is a denial of accounting as well as the science and the economics. Australia is the third largest fossil fuel exporter in the world, and this gas plan is a plan to make us even bigger. Again, this is the opposite of what the science says we need. It's the opposite of what the UN Secretary General says we need. It's the opposite of what the International Energy Agency says we need if we want to keep climate change to 1.5 degrees. This is not complicated, but this is dangerous. This is a plan to expand the industry that's causing climate change, and we're greenwashing it and calling it a solution. It's sick.
That's the chief economist from the Australia Institute, Richard Dennis, lamenting the most recent announcement by the federal Labor government to do with gas. And this is the latest episode of Climate Conversations, and I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people, and I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Let's have a listen now to what Richard Dennis had to say in response to those Labor government announcements.
The government's just released its future gas strategy. And if you're a gas executive, today is an exciting day because the government thinks you've got a big future. The problem is, if you're interested in the climate science, this is a terribly alarming development. Because rather than tackling climate change, the Albanese government is talking about reducing the barriers to the gas industry's expansion. They've just released a 110-page strategy to help the gas industry grow. This is a denial of the climate science, and it's also a denial of the last election result, where an overwhelming number of Australians thought they were voting for candidates who were going to do something serious about climate change. And you can't tackle climate change when you're still expanding and indeed subsidising the fossil fuel industry. Now, the report's full of exciting graphs and numbers trying to tell us how important it is that the gas industry grows and how important it is to the economy. But get this, they don't even mention the petroleum resource rent tax in this whole strategy about the gas industry. And the petroleum resource rent tax is supposed to be the tax that makes sure we get our fair share from all of the money the gas industry makes. But of course, in Australia, we know that we collect more revenue from kids repaying HECS debts than we get from the gas industry paying its petroleum resource rent tax. There's a whole section in the report that talks about the contribution of the gas industry to Australia's economy, but there's only got one reference. And that's a reference to a report commissioned by the gas industry. They don't even use data from Treasury or the Department of Industry or the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Madeleine King, the Minister for Resources, or the Minister for Exporting Resources, has even written an op-ed where the headline says it all. We need more gas, apparently, to tackle climate change. According to her op-ed, we need gas to help us achieve our commitment to net zero. No. Because science. What we need is less fossil fuels, not more. This is bizarre. The Australian government is denying the climate science when it says we need to extract and burn more fossil fuels to help us lower greenhouse gas emissions. That's the opposite of the truth. And this is the same government that wants to host a UN climate conference, a COP, in 2026. This is embarrassing. She also says, and gas must remain affordable for Australians. Well, you know what made gas dear? Exporting it. Australia used to have cheap gas, and then we opened up our gas market to the rest of the world, and the price of gas trebled. Now, rather than blame the gas exports for driving up our prices, we're saying we need to export more gas if we're going to make gas cheap again. This is nonsense. They're not just denying the climate science, they're denying the economics as well. She also goes on to say that Australia's gas industry is one of our great economic success stories. And she says that it generates $72 billion worth of export income. This is nonsense. Export revenue goes to the pockets of the people who are doing the exporting. And that's the foreign-owned gas industry. 80% of Australia's gas industry is foreign-owned. The $72 billion doesn't go to you, it doesn't go to roads, it doesn't go to hospitals, it goes to gas execs and foreign shareholders in foreign-owned gas companies.
Let's stick with the Australia Institute for a moment. And here we have a senior economist, Matt Grundoff, and the chief economist, Greg Jericho, again talking about the Australian Labor government's plans for the gas industry.
So, Matt, there have been some good measures in here, help for households, but also it's an incredibly dirty budget still.
Yeah, look, this is a really dirty budget. Everything from the future gas strategy, which confirmed that the government's going to continue supporting gas beyond 2050. The fuel tax credits have now passed $10 billion, and the budget papers specifically say they're expecting fuel use to increase. This is a dirty budget. And at the same time, while the gas industry is making a mozzarella at the moment, the gas industry is going to pay less tax, less petroleum resource rate tax. They've downgraded by over $3 billion the amount they're expecting to collect from the gas industry.
I mean, the PRT is so woeful that actually this financial year, more tax is going to be paid by people who bought luxury cars than by the extremely profitable gas industry in the PRT. It's an absolute disgrace. We know in the past, tobacco smokers, beer drinkers, spirits drinkers, even people purchasing visas to go overseas are paying more money than the gas companies are on PRT. It absolutely reveals in this budget. It's still dirty, still full, chock full of fossil fuel dependency. That needs to change. It was a real missed opportunity, because we're still locked into this situation of favouring fossil fuel companies, and it's something that absolutely needs to change and needs to change right now.
Yeah, look, apparently, as far as the government is concerned, they want to lose weight, so they're eating more junk food. They want to quit smoking, so they're smoking more cigarettes. And the government thinks that the way to reduce greenhouse gases is to burn more fossil fuels.
Join me now as we listen to 90 Seconds from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. When a river reaches the ocean, it becomes an estuary, a place where fresh water mixes with salt water.
You'll have wetland habitats, marshes, peatlands, swamps, your traditional swamp, mangroves in certain parts of the U.S.,
Tony Castelletto is with the Center for the Blue Economy at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. In 2021, he studied the economic value of just six estuaries and found that they'll provide more than $1 billion of environmental benefits over a 30-year period. Wetlands and mangroves act as flood barriers, protecting coastal cities from storm surges. Estuaries also store carbon in plants and soil, keeping it out of the atmosphere where it would contribute to global warming. Many estuaries are threatened by development and sea level rise. So Castelletto says that highlighting the amount of flood damage that they prevent and the value of the carbon they store could help motivate people to protect them and help officials assess the costs of those efforts.
It's not just a matter of protecting these beautiful things because they're beautiful. It's a very pragmatic decision to preserve benefits and services that you're getting right now, essentially for free.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now we have the early section of a podcast from Radio New Zealand. It's entitled The Detail. Let's have a listen now. And you'll find a link for the podcast in the show notes.
What a week in the energy world.
Back to this mess that is our energy sector. It's all about, it's really come to a head this week, hasn't it?
It started like this.
Now, Genesis Energy has said it's going to have to start importing coal again because of dwindling gas supply.
But it says with gas supply falling faster than projected, it's currently the only affordable option to keep the country's lights on.
Then out of the blue, this.
New Zealanders are being urged to reduce power usage tomorrow morning to avoid some parts of the country running out of electricity.
But wait, there's more.
A dramatic explosion on the sun has set off a storm in space.
The biggest solar storm in 20 years has prompted Transpower to shut down some lines around the country. I'm Sharon Brett Kelly. Today on The Detail, power surges, power shortages, political power games, all happening while New Zealanders head outside to catch a glimpse of a powerful night sky show.
This goes to the issue of security of supply, which is tight, and we need to restore confidence in our electricity sector so we can get the investment needed.
But let's be honest, the last government, I don't want to personalise this, they took a punt on unicorn kisses that the wind would blow and the sun would shine and the rain would always fall and we wouldn't need natural resources. Well, it's not proven to be true.
Is it really that drastic?
Operating an electricity supply system, you know, the whole thing happens absolutely in real time, and look, you can be out of balance for literally a matter of seconds and, you know, things can come really unstuck. But I didn't mention that to scare anyone.
Electricity expert Greg Sice will tell us more soon. But first, how a few thousand households kept their lights and heaters on full bore and fed electricity back into the grid. Solar Zero's CEO Matt Ward explains his company's response when Transpower warned of a power deficit of 20 megawatts.
That's about the size of a Huntley, basically.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's significant. So Transpower got together the sector and they sort of called on everybody to do what they could, you know, turn on extra generation. And so we made the decision to fully deploy our virtual power plant, and we decided to fully export at that time to try and avert that energy crisis.
And please don't forget, you'll find a link for that in the show notes. Here now is a story from The Conversation. It has the headline, "Solar Power Occupies a Lot of Space. Here's how to make it more ecologically beneficial to the land it sits on." Let's listen now to this small piece from that story.
The image of a shepherd tending a flock of sheep goes back centuries, but lately it's gotten quite a modern update. In many parts of the country, agricultural land is now home to the massive panels of the booming solar energy industry. And that land remains suitable for grazing farm animals, which in turn control the growth of vegetation around the panels. Solar grazing, as it's known, is just one example of the agri-solar industry, a growing space which combines the old and new to enhance both the economy and the environment.
You ready, Reg?
Oh, wait a minute.
It is a border collie's dream come true. 6 acres of land calling for Reggie to do what she was born to do.
Good girl, Anna. Get up, Reg. Get up.
Herding a flock of 32 sheep under the watchful eye of her owner.
Good girl, good girl. Hi, sheep.
Dan Finnegan.
One well-trained border collie like Reggie is worth 5 full-time employees.
Wow.
Between the sheep and the dog, I'm just a driver.
Here we go.
Dan is more than just a driver. He's a third-generation sheep farmer in southeastern Massachusetts. And while this isn't his family farm, it is Dan, Reggie, and the flock's office for the day. Together, they make up Solar Shepherd, working with large energy companies across the U.S. using the sheep to graze sites like this one, which host solar arrays. In Dan's words, they're in the landscaping business.
Did people think you were crazy or
at
not?
The very beginning, at
yeah.
the very beginning, the conversations were centered around, you'd like to do what on our solar array?
Yeah.
Now that's not so much the case. Good girl, lie down.
Dan started Solar Shepherd 5 years ago.
Why do you think it's been embraced so easily now, or at least so well now?
Well, first and foremost, the sheep do a great job.
Excellent workers.
They're wonderful workers. They do a great job of managing the vegetation on the solar array. They fit underneath the solar panels. The old-fashioned way of managing these sites would be to come in with a crew of 5 or 8 guys on zero-turn mowers, with the bulk of their time spent running weed whackers underneath the solar panels to get all that vegetation that grows under there. You know, a site like this, you'd probably send an 8-man crew for 3 days each time they mow it, at least 3 or 4 times a year.
Time and money.
Time and money.
There's also the environmental impact. According to a recent study, if all sheep in the U.S. were shifted to agri-solar farms, the reduction in carbon emissions would be the same as removing 117,000 cars from the road. This field, which Solar Shepherd grazes, is one of 30 owned and operated by National Grid, responsible for providing power to more than 20 million customers in the Northeast.
This brings energy into the grid.
Steve Werner is the president for National Grid New England.
What was it about AgriSolar that attracted National Grid?
It's an interesting solution to a problem that we have, right? So we installed large-scale solar for residents of Massachusetts. We need to maintain the vegetation, the grass that grows on those properties. We came across this idea and said, hey, this is a win-win. It's cost-effective. It's environmentally responsible, it's friendly to the neighbors, and this is just another example of how an area that was agricultural use still can be and also be a generator.
Those stacked benefits from solar grazing, especially when it comes to the environment, are exceeding expectations, according to Stacy Peterson.
You know, we're seeing sometimes a threefold increase in pollinators. We're seeing three times the amount of birds and bees, bats, butterflies.
She's the energy program director at NCAT's AgriSolar Clearinghouse, a government-funded information hub for all things AgriSolar.
How much has this industry grown in the last 5 to 10 years?
So much. This is taking off all across the country and all across the world, really. We're there to help you figure out what's best for your area and connect you with the right people that might help you do this if you want this at your farm or if you want this in your community.
Solar grazing is just one of many in the AgriSolar sphere. On solar sites nationwide, there are pollinators and beekeeping, crops grown, cattle raised, even fish farmed. Peterson says the opportunities appear endless.
So this is going to be a game changer in being able to move forward sustainably.
People may not see agriculture and solar as fitting together naturally. Why would you say that they maybe do?
I think that it is another crop. They're harvesting the sun again. They are providing the crop of energy. And they're doing that in a way that they can sustain their farm. I'm talking to farmers that they're able to pay for their farm for generations. They look at this as a way to be a good steward of the land. It does not come in with a mini mall. It doesn't come in with a residential development. This is something that can be returned completely to agricultural lands.
And with the number and size of farms in the U.S. steadily declining over the last 15 years.
Hey, Lee. Rich, Tadaloo here.
That may be the relief many have been looking for. It certainly has been for Dan Finnegan and Reggie.
Without this solar operation and the added pasture it brings us, we wouldn't have a sustainable farm. We need this. And I think there are a lot of other farmers in that same boat. When you think about how many animals you need to produce a living, particularly in the Northeast here, it takes a lot of acreage to do that. So the 100 acres of solar pasture we have under management, that makes our farm sustainable. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't be able to continue. So we're producing food, fiber, and energy all from the same acre of land. It's a smarter way to use this land.
Mm. I kept sort of looking for, well, what's the negative? Because you start looking, and really the hardest thing seemed to be maybe for some of the farmers that upfront cost of if they had to cart some of their sheep around or if some of the planting was different. But it really seems like everybody is getting the win out of this, even if there is some upfront cost in the beginning. You make up for it in so many other ways.
Might get incentivized at some point.
Certainly, and if you can keep your farm or your business going for generations, that's incentive right there.
Join me now as you listen to the session covering climate now, telling your story locally. It's an issue that's of great concern to me because I'm a reporter. I'm trying to tell the story locally about climate change. It's almost impossible. But let's listen now to what they have to say, and you'll find a link for the entire event in the show notes.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another Covering Climate Now Talking Shop. I'm Kyle Pope. I'm one of the founders of Covering Climate Now, and we're really, really happy to have you here today. We're going to talk about telling the climate story locally. But first, for those of you who don't know, Covering Climate Now is a global collaboration of journalists from all over the world. We're organized by journalists, for journalists, and our job simply is to help one another do a better job of covering what we see as the defining story of our time. We'd love to hear from you. Please reach out, coveringclimatenow.org. Just one programming note from us. This year, Covering Climate Now launched the Climate Station, which is a program to help local TV stations across the U.S. improve their climate coverage. All sessions take place on Zoom, and they're customized for each market. So whether you're a meteorologist or a general reporter or an assignment editor or a digital producer, we're joining all these people together and helping us find ways to connect the climate story with our audience to give them solutions. And we, again, love to hear from you. We'll drop a link in the chat with more information on that. But again, please reach out. So let's get on to today's session, which will be led today by David Schechter. He's the National Environment Correspondent for CBS News and Stations with nearly 30 years of local news experience and a commitment to helping local newsrooms elevate their climate coverage. He's well suited to guide our panelists through an hour-long conversation about how to cover climate locally effectively and how to engage audiences while they're doing it.
Sadly, I've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations, and my screen is still alive with stories about the climate crisis, but I can't get to them all, and so I'll put links to as many as I can in the show notes. Thanks for your company. It's been great to be along now. I'd love you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Also, I'd love to hear from you. I want to know what you think about this podcast, so you can contact me at r.mclean7@iCloud.com. Don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Beyond that, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so if you've got something to say about the climate crisis, contact me by that email address I mentioned earlier, and I can contact you via email, via the phone, or via Zoom, and we can have a chat about the climate crisis. And beyond all that, please help me spread the news about the climate crisis. Let people know, put it on your networks, help them understand how important it is that they understand the climate crisis. Also, don't forget to check out the show notes, as there'll be many links in there. And finally, thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe.